This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Ralph Friedman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Project, welcome back to this episode. We are in the studio today with Luke Tulloch, who is a local personal trainer in Sydney. Quite a large online presence. And, you know, the reason this episode came about is because so many people were contacting me to tell me to get him on the show. When that happens a few times and they're local, it's inevitable that we will bring that person in. So Luke is he has studied neuroscience at university. He's a personal trainer, number one. He works with all kinds of different athletes, gen pop, bodybuilders, powerlifters, and Luke also is a athlete slash bodybuilder himself. He's a very large man, very well-built man. Kind of looks like an Australian Viking, I would say.
Yeah.
And he managed to join us just before he took off on his adventure to travel overseas indefinitely. So we're very fortunate to get him in last minute. And Luke is just a great person at bridging the gap between the science that we have, the research, and its impact on training for the general population and coaching people. So this episode today is all about bridging that gap between what's in science, what's in the research, and what is actually happening on the ground in gyms and how all that is working out.
He's just, you know, he's like the PT that if I was like, send a client or my mom to go get a PT, I just dream she ends up with Luke Tulloch as the PT.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And what I love about Luke is he's very open to sharing his journey so far. And he talks about, you know, being a very regimented type of personality and how he's managed to transition that into something that's a little more fluid, a little more relaxed. So some really interesting and deep conversations in this episode with Luke. So our first sponsor today.
We have Working Against Gravity, and interesting, we recorded another Monday episode today. We're just talking about how this athlete is like, you know, very, I guess, world-class powerlifter, and he gets nutrition coaching, and it's why I do think nutrition coaching is essential for everyone that gives the gym a really good crack at some point, because you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff I've got from nutrition coaches over the years, I was like, oh, this is stupid. Yeah. I know I don't need to do this, and I was very surprised I was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, because you can just learn so much, but having like an actual expert look in, see what's working and suggest something that very often you wouldn't have thought of, just like it expands your knowledge about how food works with your body.
Yeah, for sure. If you've even hired a personal trainer or you've got coaching in some respect, it's for your training, it should be definitely something you do at some point for your nutrition as well. Like someone who specializes specifically in nutrition, definitely personal trainers can help if they are qualified. But most of them specialize in training. Most of them have invested most of their educational dollars and time in training. So getting a coach for nutrition, and it's not someone that you're going to need indefinitely. You might just get them for 3 months. You might get them for 6 months. But you learn so much in that time that you carry it over into the next decade, two, three, four decades of your life. And it's just invaluable knowledge.
And everybody gets in better shape.
Absolutely. Yeah. So guys, if you go to workingagainstgravity.com and you want some really good nutrition coaching delivered on their app, and you use the code MMP50, you are going to get a $50 discount when you check out for the online coaching. $50 discount off the first month. So workingagainstgravity.com, MMP50, one word when you check out, and you're going to get that discount.
And also, the show is brought to you today by True Protein. So I don't know how much True Protein Lachie and I have consumed over our time, but it must be in the tons.
Astronomical.
At this point.
Yeah.
Even just the amount of waste of empty True Protein bags makes me know how much we have put away over time.
Yeah.
We've consumed it all the way from crazy CrossFit workouts to during a 10,000 calorie challenge to overseas in America. It has come everywhere. And it's because it's the number one, and in Australia by so far, it is the number one like natural protein brand out there.
Yeah. My only hope is that more people, because the price tag of True Protein is a little bit higher than other brands, my only hope is that people realize that, you know, if you're going to be using supplements on a regular basis, it's the same way that you wouldn't go and buy like really cheap meat from you know, whatever your supermarket might be, right? There's definitely some meats where, you know, they are the bottom of the barrel meats, and there are other meats that you buy that are, you know, slightly higher cut and, you know, organic and a little bit, you know, more ethically raised. And then there's like the really expensive high quality butcher meats, you know. True really is kind of that high quality butcher meats. And then, you know, if you are consuming these things all the time, you know, different if you, you know, trying to buy steak and you're having it once a week, then, you know, maybe if you don't have it every day, you could have a cheap cut every now and then. But it's that accumulation of, you know, really bad products that you put into your body every day. Some of them are used with such cheap fillers, cheap byproducts, poor manufacturing processes. And there are so many like heavy metals and stuff that come off into these products that end up in your body. And so when you use a company like True and that report, you know, next to zero complaints about the digestibility and how the product feels with people, then you just know you're putting something that's healthy and sustainable in your body. Because the last thing you want to do is be that person that's like, oh, I took this protein for so long, turns out it's got X bad thing in it that you've been taking for so long. So if you guys go to trueprotein.com.au and you use our code
MyMuscle10,
then you will get a 10% discount on any order that you put through. So trueprotein.com.au, MyMuscle10, one word when you check out. All right, My Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode. We are here today in the studio. The renovation's still happening, but they put it on pause for us because we told them, we're like, look, we've got Luke Tulloch in. You need to stop the renovations for one day, please. And they're like, yeah, absolutely, of course. But Luke, thanks for joining us here.
Man, pleasure to be here. Awesome.
So I heard about you saying through Eugene, Tia, and then another friend, Mel, also mentioned you within a 24-hour period. And I was like, of course, we have to get him on. It's a sign from the gods. But I assume that maybe not all our listeners would know about you and what you do. Yeah. So maybe give us a little bit of background info into what you do and why you do it.
Yeah, I've been in the industry for, I think this is my 13th year or 12th year or something like that. So the long story short is that after school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Started a business degree because I'm like, oh, that'll probably be handy, and just didn't like it. So I was like, all right, I'll do personal training while I figure out what the hell I'm going to do with my life.
Yeah,
and it just stuck. I just really loved it. Always kind of been curious, a bit academic and that sort of stuff. So I went back to uni, did neuroscience, and yeah, kind of just kept training people in the meantime. And I sort of slowly did more and more education for people, like coaches and that sort of thing. So now I'm doing education online. Coach people mostly online, or all online now since my gym I was working out of closed not too long ago, unexpectedly. And do seminars and that kind of stuff. So that's kind of me in a nutshell, I guess.
Nice.
Yeah,
that was one thing Eugene made me promise him that I would ask you about is the neuroscience stuff. So can you tell us what you did study in what aspect of it?
So when I say neuroscience, a lot of people don't really know what that is. And there's a lot of like aspects to it.
And they just nod their head like 100%.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sweet.
It's kind of smart.
Brain, right? Yeah.
NASA.
I actually started in I did biochem and psychology as a double degree to start with and kind of realized that psychology was not really my thing. Just because there's a lot more stats and study design kind of stuff that you kind of have to do to really understand that stuff. So
interpreting scientific papers. And
yeah, it's just knowing how to use statistics, and there's a lot of, you know, the practical side of, because like a lot of psychology, you're studying obviously human behavior, and you got to somehow get a result out of that. You know what I mean? It's not super. It's not as easy as like, oh, there's some numbers here, like an engineer or statistics in economics and stuff is very different, right?
Right.
So anyway, I didn't really vibe with that. And so I just kind of transferred into a neuroscience degree because it was a bit more flexible in what I could do. I was really interested in physiology, which is really just how all the different systems of the body work, like your digestive system and your nervous system and all that sort of stuff. And so like my angle was a bit more on that type of stuff. So a lot of the neuro stuff was, you know, you do your neuroanatomy, you do some of the cognitive science type of stuff, just how your brain works and all that kind of stuff. So it's not super specialized, and it's kind of more of a degree where you kind of have to do something with it afterwards to take it anywhere academically. You know, you're not getting a job as a neuroscientist, so to speak.
Right.
You're taking it into medicine or into research or further study that way. And I think, like, I obviously just kept personal training, and I think just having the background in how the body works and some of the chemistry behind it and some of the critical thinking was like the most useful thing, because I could use that to then go and learn about more of the stuff I liked. You know, I could read studies, I could analyze articles and go, oh, I kind of know a little bit about how some of this stuff works, and so that makes sense, but that doesn't really make sense to me or whatever. So that's kind of what I did with it, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
And so how are you applying it now to your sort of training with clients?
Yeah, it's I think it's about building on that knowledge. So the scope of what I cover with clients is pretty broad. It's not only training and nutrition. It's about health and lifestyle and stuff too. So things like sleep or making social connections with people or learning or hobbies or all that sort of stuff I'm really interested in too.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a really big part of happiness and well-being that is kind of ignored a little bit.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, training and nutrition can be promoted at the expense of some of that stuff, and then people end up kind of really just unhappy and unhealthy as a result.
Right.
Like, you don't need friends, you just hit your macros and...
Yeah, yeah, dude. Well, but I mean, that's what it turns into, and like, I was like that too, where all I cared about was lifting weights, yeah. And, you know, at the end of the day, why? Like, yeah. What for? I mean, yeah. It is good, obviously. It's got some massive benefits.
Don't worry, we're sold.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Sometimes when I say that, people are like, oh my God, my world's like blowing apart right here. But, you know, that's honestly where it is. So, you know, so how do I use the neuroscience? Well, I think, like I say, it gave me that background to go, well, I can explore some of the literature out there. And I still, like, that's a daily habit of mine is reading scientific literature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of the time you're not necessarily telling your clients like, oh, and this study said this. It's more just you get a better overall view of maybe how you can help people and an angle you can go in, because everybody's got their own little thing going on. And so that, I think, is the most helpful thing, is that if you do understand some of that physiology, some of the neuroscience, the anatomy, all of that stuff, it gives you it orients you. So it's like, I understand some of the words I'm reading on this piece of paper right now. I can understand how it fits into the bigger picture of things. Mm. Rather than like skimming a study or an article and going, what's the conclusion? What's the end point? Yeah. You can kind of orient yourself better.
Yeah.
So I guess that's really how I mostly use it. And so I've taken that concept over into the education that I do. So I do like online education for trainers, and it is teaching that sort of fundamental physiology and biology and chem to trainers, so that they have that grounding in it, you know, because I just think, like, if you're going to teach your clients how to lift weights or to eat or whatever, like, you should probably understand a little bit of the basis behind it. You don't need to be a genius or, yeah, like really into it, but to understand it's helpful, right?
Mm. Yeah, I was listening to your podcast that you did on NEAT,
mm,
which I thought was really good, and you were like kind of talking about science, but not too heavy to the point that, yeah, you lost the message, and it was really good, and it's like, yeah, you just don't think that NEAT is actually every single thing outside, yeah, of like training, you know, and you were like, chewing gum is one of those things. I was, yeah, like, yeah, right, yeah, of, yeah, course. And it's just, it really is any sort of behavior that you're doing it contributes significantly. It's like, it is that big factor to weight loss or weight gain.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of it is, you know, like they talk about the art of coaching and then the science of it, right? And I think it's trying to blend that, because you need to know where you can apply that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Especially to an individual. There's a lot of stuff I read where I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. But at the end of the day, am I really going to use it with most clients when what they actually need to do is maybe just be a bit more consistent or something? You know what I mean?
Mm.
So it's an interesting thing trying to like figure that stuff out, rather than just being a nerd and being like, well, this is what the science is.
Right. And so what are some of the things now you're leaning more towards with coaching your clients? Like, for our evolution, obviously, with coaching our clients is, yeah, it's been like you start with all the heavy science and all the big, yeah, words, and you realize they don't do anything. And then you kind of try and find more of a middle ground. They still don't do anything. You're like, okay, wow. It's like the most basic, easy things that we can do here to make any sort of change, because, yeah, it is very difficult to get people to change.
It's super hard. That's the biggest challenge, really. I think a lot of people don't really know, I suppose, but fundamentally, most people know like roughly what a healthy diet looks like. And like, yeah, I should exercise this much. I should, you know, do some weights and do some cardio, and maybe I should do some mobility and all this sort of stuff. But it's really doing it that is the issue a lot of the time. So for every client that I have, it's finding that entry point into what's the lowest hanging fruit for them. You know, so I give you an example. I have one client who's like a pretty high level gymnast, and she trains like a machine. It's like 20 hours a week of training, of, yeah, gymnastic training, right? And so for her, it's literally all we've done is she feels really anxious when she tries to sleep, and she found it hard to sleep. I was like, right, that's easily the lowest hanging fruit here. If we can get that up, everything else is going to improve. You're already doing tons. That's really, really good and high level. And so for her, it was like 6 weeks of like just kind of getting on her case a little bit to do some like body scanning type mindfulness work, like an hour before bed. And honestly, the return that we got on that was unreal, like unbelievable, you know? And so I could go into the science of like, yeah, you got to time your food this way and recovery methods and these supplements and all that sort of stuff. You could do that, but none of that's ever going to give you the return that just like getting some better sleep is going to give you.
Mm.
And I think you fall into this trap when you're a coach and it's like, yeah, man, I'm charging online clients like $100 a week or whatever it is. Which is a lot of money, and you know, they're expecting something magic. Like, oh, this guy's got a neuroscience degree and he's going to give me something, you know, like I haven't ever thought of and no one else is doing.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, for me, it's like, well, what can I do to give you the result that's going to have the least friction involved? Mm. You know, I don't want to give you something that is super fancy and stuff. It's going to give us 1%, but it's going to take so much effort to get that 1% when I could do something simple and just make you do it.
Yeah.
That's going to give you way more. And so you're getting your money's worth that way. But that's kind of the angle that I go with on a lot of my clients. And so a lot of them are actually pretty good at, you know, tracking their macros and like getting in and training hard and all that sort of stuff. And where they fall down is having the flexibility, having the lifestyle outside of training and outside the gym. And don't get me wrong, there's tons of people who come in who need that sort of stuff. They like need more of the training side or more of the like, hey, this is what a good protein source is, or whatever it is, like the simple stuff. But a lot of it is really just finding that low-hanging fruit, like where can we get the most bang for buck here and chasing that. I think that's massive, and that's something that, like, for me as well, is what I'm all about. Is there's areas in my life outside of training and nutrition where I'm trying to find those little bits and pieces where I can make myself happier, make myself a better human, that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Well, there was that, we talked about it on one of our after shows, but I think it was, I think it's 80 years the study's been going for in Harvard. And it was like a group of, I know John F. Kennedy was one of the candidates from the group. It was like a cohort from a Harvard group, and it was like 250 guys, around that number. And they were looking at the factors that correlate with longevity.
Yeah.
It's a pretty famous study. You might have heard some of the recent reports on it and articles, but...
And being president must have been bad for him. Dude, yeah. Shut in the head.
For him, it didn't go well. But the one thing that they correlated that was like more important than like socioeconomic status, like physical health, whether they smoked or they drank, like all this sort of stuff, was deep and meaningful connections with other people. So they were saying like your risk of dying is the same as if you smoke 2 packets of cigarettes a day than if you had no deep meaningful relationships in your life. And you think that the fitness industry is such a weird space where like you see so many, like being extreme is glorified. You know, being like the strongest, craziest guy ever, or being like the most shredded guy ever is extreme. And probably speaking for all of us, probably felt like that guy or wanted to be that guy at one point. And you sacrifice all those things. You sacrifice the thing that now this study is showing us could be the most important thing for your longevity.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. Like, but I think that's where the hard part comes in, because at some point you got to still get people motivated to train and to like watch what they eat, right? You can't go, well, that doesn't really matter that much. You just need to focus on like social stuff and then go, oh, sweet, I'm going partying. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that's really where the challenge lies, because for a lot of people, the easiest thing for them to do is to be the robot who never misses a training session and tracks every single meal.
Right.
But being able to find the balance between that and like laissez-faire, just do whatever you want, that's really the challenging thing. And a lot of people view that having that flexibility and like, oh yeah, I had a drink one, like a couple of nights or like whatever I did, I missed a training session. They view that as like being weak and not good enough or whatever. But really for them, that could be the thing that is actually the more difficult thing to do. Right. And it's where the challenge lies and where they're going to get better. So it's kind of an interesting spin on it, but I totally agree. So I started pursuing some of that stuff, like what is going to make you happier and live longer and all that sort of stuff. And so went down a massive rabbit hole of that, of what are the effects of expressing gratitude or picking up a new hobby or whatever it is, which I think I used to avoid because I felt it was a little bit wishy-washy and it was a little bit woo. But I think especially in today's climate, I think people are recognizing that stuff more, with like mindfulness and things like that are rising in terms of popularity, and people are recognizing how important that stuff is. And so it is easier to kind of get into that stuff. So I don't know. I think there's like a lot of ground to be gained there for a lot of people.
Why do you think it is that we do have that? Like, I find that struggle as well. Like, I know that we have heaps of research to show that meditation is extremely beneficial for recovery, for example, right? For the things that I care about. Yet, still, when I hear certain people talk about it and I hear them talk about gratefulness and stuff, it does sound so wishy-washy that I almost think, there's no way this could work. Yeah. Like, is it the competing sides of the brain? Is it like a left-right brain thing? Like, one's so logical and one's more creative and that's like, nah, can't work, or...
I think that could be it, hey, because you get those archetypes of how people think where some people are very, I hate to say it, but more spiritual, that kind of personality, and other people are a little bit more like, man, the numbers are what I'm chasing. Like, let's be objective about this. And I'm very much that way. I'm logical and analytical. My wife is a bit more like, this feels good. I'm intuitive and that sort of stuff. And I think, so you have that, and then you have the history of it. Unfortunately, when you say meditation, it tends to have a connotation to, you know, Buddhism or some kind of religious or spiritual kind of thing, which it doesn't need to have. So I like using the right language with the right client. Like some people, if you say to them meditation or something like that, they're like, yeah, sweet, I'm into that, no worries. And some people you say to that and they go, whoa, dude, listen, come on.
Yeah.
I'm paying you here for some actual, like, something tangible, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so using different language around that can be a bit more helpful. Okay. But I think it's hard because it's got those connotations and stuff. But then I think there's another dimension to it, which is just the issue of delayed gratification. Like if you start meditating, there's definitely a case of like you could meditate and feel better afterwards, but you're not going to experience enlightenment or like suddenly like, oh yeah, now I'm all chilled and relaxed and I respond well to every situation. It takes heaps of work, you know.
Right.
It's really hard and you might not see the benefits of it for several months and you've got to do it pretty consistently. So it's one of those things. It's like sometimes when people diet, for example, I tend to, if someone can handle it, I go really hard with the diet. I might go like, we're doing a 40% deficit straight off the bat, because if they see results quickly, it motivates them to stick with it. And you can transition into like something that's a bit more sustainable after that period.
How long will you run that for?
It really depends on the person, but it might just be, you know, 2 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
And so they might drop a couple of kilos in like the first couple of weeks and be like, holy shit, I can see the difference straight away.
Right.
Whereas if you give them something that's a bit like, okay, well, let's eat a bit more vegetables, or maybe let's do a 20% deficit if they're tracking or whatever it is, it can take a while for them to see that same kind of result. And then the buy-in is so much harder to get.
Right.
So you can't kind of brute force meditation or mindfulness or anything of that nature in the same way that you can kind of do it with training or or diet, which is hard, man. So you it's like delayed versus instant gratification as well, and that's super tough.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't think about it like that, but the buy-in part is huge.
Yeah, it's huge. Really big. And like some people, like I said, you can, the buy-in for a meditation, it's kind of like they just needed someone to say, hey, you should do this, and then they're like, oh yeah, I should do that.
Yeah.
And then they just do it. But even me, like, I know the benefits of it, and like, I'm really inconsistent with my meditation or whatever, or mindfulness or whatever it is. I'm super inconsistent with it. I might do it 6 weeks straight, sweet, and then I'll drop off for a couple of months.
And you notice a big difference tangibly?
Yeah, I notice a really big difference.
Like what?
I feel more. So my wife does a really big, she does like, she's got a little like online breathing course. She's into like mobility and she does hand balancing, handstands, calisthenic type stuff. And so she does this breathing work with a lot of her students. And so she described it as having a buffer between you and the outside world, or like a bit of a space where you can choose how you react to stuff.
Mm.
And I found that was like a really good analogy for it, because it just feels like you're a little bit more in control of how you feel towards things and react to things and that kind of stuff. And it kind of springs up in all facets of life, whether it's training or any situation you find yourself in where you might have found yourself reacting a certain way or being frustrated or stuck in a certain pattern, a certain habit that you don't necessarily want to have. It kind of gives you almost the space to step back and recognize it when you might not have even before.
Mm.
You go, oh, okay, actually, I was being unreasonable in that situation, or I felt really frustrated when it really wasn't a big deal, or whatever. So that's kind of the benefit that I find, is that it almost gives me that ability to separate myself a little bit from that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the big teachings of Stoic philosophy, right? Is like,
yeah, totally.
Not reacting and realizing that you're in control of how you react to things, right? So yeah, huge. I think was it Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning? He wrote about that's where life is. It's the gap between emotion and reaction.
I just started reading that.
Oh, did you?
It's been on my to-read list for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. So all those to-read lists, I got Blinkist recently. Have you heard of Blinkist?
I have heard of it,
And I powered through like 20 different titles in like, I don't know, a couple of days or whatever. And I think it's good because, you want to read the whole book if you really want a certain message to sink in, but you definitely... Like, for example, someone sent me in Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. Mm-hmm. Or is that what it's called?
Yep.
Yeah. And I read it because their message was like, hey, you have to read this book, but just get the message somehow because the whole book's a waste of time. You get it in like one chapter. Yeah. And so, that's how I found Blinkist. I got it. And I was cool. Oh, shit, I can just power through all these books. And then I ordered like 3 out of 20.
Yeah, yeah. The ones you like, you can kind of read more. But I find that as well. A lot of those... I think that maybe that's another thing as well. Like a lot of those books where it's, I guess they're self-help in a way, but a lot of the business books and stuff too, it's kind of like it's a blog post or an article that they've padded into a book.
Right.
I get really annoyed with them. I get a quarter of the way through and I'm like, I cannot keep doing this. Like I'm done.
So yeah.
If I can get the message, like I'm pretty happy.
What I find interesting now though is like the more successful people I talk about and whatever field they're in is very few of them actually read business books. Like a lot of them they'll read... philosophy, they'll read like maths and science and they'll read like really old books and stuff because they're like most business stuff is just like just accumulation of principles from these other fields that people are just writing about in a business context.
And
it's kind of true.
Well, I agree with that, and one of my big things is this concept that like society as a whole has gotten more and more specialized. And that's a good thing, right? Mm. Because like you want to have people who are like,
working on a flu vaccine.
Exactly. Yeah. You want to be able to go to a gastroenterologist if you have a problem there, or like an engineer who's like really good at building a bridge. Like you need that stuff. Society wouldn't be the way it is without that. However, I think we do lose a bit of like general skills, you know? And you can take that from someone who's like a mega expert, like PhD kind of realm, or you can take it from the everyday person where, I want to be able to like change the wheel on my car. I don't want to have to call somebody to do that. I want to be able to make something with my hands if I wanted to make a basic table and do some woodwork or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to be able to pick up an instrument and like strum a few chords or whatever. Or languages or any of those things. And I think, reading is one of those things where it gives you an opportunity to expose yourself to knowledge and ideas that are outside of your field. And I think that's super important because at the end of the day, you can end up applying that to your field, no matter what it is.
Right.
There's concepts in there. And, for me, I'm actually, I read textbooks, I read research papers and stuff, but I'd struggle with nonfiction books. And I love reading fiction. I love reading like fantasy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I genuinely think that some of the themes and ideas in that, or just the way that some authors express themselves is like genuinely helpful for what I do as a job.
Right.
So I think there's really something to that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, I mean, even just like some of the people that we've spoken to and stuff, and they'll say stuff like, oh yeah, I really enjoy reading fantasy novels, or I enjoy this type of music or whatever. And it just like... it's almost a bit of a sideswipe, but then you realize that, well, actually, we should have a diverse amount of interest and stuff because, when you're just so specialized, it gets exhausting, right?
Yeah.
The last thing you want to do is like go home and then your relaxing activity is just more a different variation of your work. It's like, it's shit. I mean, it's cool for a while because you're in it. It's like, back when we were doing like competitive CrossFit, like everything was CrossFit.
Totally.
It was like CrossFit. It was just like CrossFit porn on our computer all the time, right? We couldn't get enough of it. Like, new video would come out, text you, check it out, and then...
it was so much, you almost couldn't stop it. It was like, close the browser, some new browser would just pop up. Like,
With more CrossFit. Yeah. And then eventually, we just like, dude, I can't even look at it. Like, it makes me sick. Like, you just over-consume it. And I think that's kind of how, we end up getting with a lot of things. And it could be, in a way, like a lot of people's unhappiness is like they are just doing way too much of the same thing over and over again. And they're so stressed about that one thing. And it's just never ending. Like I see it with the guys at the gym, especially the guys in like finance and stuff. Like their life is about all financial stuff. Yeah. Their Instagram feed, their LinkedIn feed, like their Facebook feed, everything.
Yeah, man. There's something like weirdly hypnotic or like attractive... when you see like those, like the Japanese craftsmen or like sushi masters or whatever, it's like, I was a sushi apprentice and they didn't even let me touch the fish until I'd been washing rice for 3 years. And you're like, holy shit, man, this guy does one thing so well. And you think it's cool, but...
surely he's sad.
Yeah, but dude, at the same time, like there was one study that I posted about on my Instagram where the psychologists look at something called self-efficacy, and it's just your ability to kind of deal with challenging situations and trust yourself, I guess. And they found that the people who had more hobbies that were less like their work and more leisure time ended up going further in their careers and having more self-efficacy. So it's like it actually carried over to their job to have something like outside of work that was different. So to me, that kind of embodies what I'm about, right?
Yeah, there was that. I've brought it up a few times, but the study they did in Japan, I'm not sure if you heard about it recently. They took like a massive Japanese software company or something, or some kind of thousands of employees, basically, right? Huge turnover. And they gave them a three-day weekend, so a four-day working week. Yep. And it wasn't like the previous experiments they'd done in some of the Nordic countries, where I think they'd given them three-day weekends, but they'd still doing the same hours same in a hours, working. Yeah. This was the same hours as the 4 days. So they lost the hours from the 5th day. They didn't make it up. And like for a massive company to increase by 1 to 2% is like,
yeah, that's, yeah,
it's insane. That's like millions and millions of dollars, right? 30% increase in productivity. Fuck, yeah. And that's like in Japan with a culture that, like, when people pass out in the office from like exhaustion, like they get applauded.
Yeah, yeah, they're like, oh man, what a weapon.
Yeah, like you're a hero.
Yeah.
And so that surely has something to, because if you think about the psychology of having, you know, if you finished work on Thursday night, like from Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you have so much extra time. You'll probably end up doing more things because you're like, well, I have this extra time. Let's go learn like dance lessons, or let's like get into surfing and do surf trips. Like let's, I don't know, practice some other thing. And you just, yeah, I think in terms of just like the health of your brain as well, right?
Yeah, I agree.
It's like huge, huge impacts, and gives them space and energy for the things that, you know, they need to do to make money.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. And being someone who like works out of a home office, I find that, I think if I worked in a traditional job, like 9 to 5, or like most jobs are probably more than that, really, like they're probably more like 8 to 6 for most people in an office.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just don't think I'd get much done. It's just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas I find I can get really hyper-focused, and if you have that autonomy to kind of work on the task as you see fit, then the productivity goes through the roof, and I find I can get like heaps done. I really don't think I would get as much done in an office sort of situation with traditional structure like that. Not that I've ever worked in that environment.
Do you know Naval Ravikant? Yeah, so on his podcast, I don't know if you've listened to it. It is kind of like a business podcast, but it's more like a wealth podcast, wealth philosophy. But yeah, his whole thing is that humans are designed to work like lions in sprints. Genetically, that's how we work. So we're not good to be able to, say, pick an 80-hour work week and just work continuously, right? Like a slow jog. He said what we're better at is like a really big sprint. So like maybe a project, you build this online program, all this content, you like go hard, you release it, and then it's like, then you chill for a long time and you analyze and you watch, and then you repeat. And he goes, that's where in Silicon Valley, that's how people are most effective, is they do everything in these like...
They got that like crunch time, right?
Yeah. Right, these short sprints. And that's why Google, I think, or maybe it was Facebook, they've got this structure for one of their teams, whatever arm of, I don't know, let's say it's like, I don't know, Google Maps team, for example. One of their teams right now, they're experimenting with no work hours or days or schedules, nothing. And no, like you don't have to come to the office, you don't have to check in, you just have a thing that you have to complete, and you have like, I don't know, they say they give them 6 months. It's like, do it however you want to go about it. And like, we've heard the stories of like, you know, the different things in Google that have been successful came out of that time that Google gives them for leisure. They say, you know, you get resources and time every week. Not sure how much they get. I think maybe they get like 4 or 5 hours a week and a certain allowance to work on any project they want.
Right.
They can do anything they want. I think that's how Google Earth came about and some other like crazy things as well. And just makes you think like, we aren't supposed to fit into these boxes. They don't work. They're too restrictive. Like, we set up watching the tennis the other night, the final. Everyone wakes up tired the next day.
Yeah.
And they're forced to go into an office. You know, my girlfriend's sister, she was forced to go there. And she's like, all day, all I was doing was looking at the clock, just going, I got to get home and nap. I got to get home and nap. She's like, I'm exhausted. Can't do any high-level thinking. So, what's the point?
Yeah, totally.
Being there for the sake of being there.
Totally.
But you're not going to get anything done.
No, I agree with that. Totally. Like, you know, and everybody's got their own sort of way of doing it as well, you know. So when you're shoving everyone into the same structure, it's kind of like, well, you're probably going to get, there's some people who maybe work quite well in that kind of structure,
right?
But there's going to be a lot of people who don't as well. Which, you know, like you got to try and get the most out of everybody, really, instead of being like, well, you know, survivorship bias, the top 10% who just happen to do really well with this kind of setup are going to make it through and be the CEOs or the managers or whatever. Right. And everybody
force the
else
other people
is kinda,
to do it every day.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And everyone else is kind of going to just drag and try and get through it.
Yeah.
Like, it's a weird way of doing it, I guess.
It's also the same approach that we're taking with training, I think. Mm. Is like people are forcing themselves just go harder and harder and harder till they crash and then they stop for a bit and they get, you know, out of shape again, and then they try again. Like, all right, play this time harder.
Like, yeah. Didn't go hard enough last time. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, I think when I started to realize it was because when we essentially retired from the sport of CrossFit, we just like, you know, too many injuries, too banged up. And we were training a lot, like very hard, very often. And, you know, it was just this fear, I think, that I had that I didn't, you know, confront fully that if I stop training this hard, like I'm gonna turn to like just a soft blob, or I'm just gonna be skinny fat. And you know, I took the intensity way down, took the volume way down, and if anything, it got better.
Yeah,
I was like, what the fuck? You know, I thought intensity was the key, because like we were sold, intensity is the key to like to results. It's only one factor that's involved.
Yeah.
In fact, if you're just more consistent and you auto regulate better, you'll actually get better results.
Totally. It's a weird thing. You just get bred into the fact of like, you know, work hard and then you'll get what you deserve sort of thing. And so when you don't get what you deserve, you're like, wow, must not have worked hard enough. Or you don't get what you want, I should say.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. You know, like, it's super weird. I mean, I'm the same. Like, my training, sometimes I don't post a lot of my own training and all that sort of stuff on my social media or anything like that. Because it's honestly, it's disappointing for most people to see like what I do. And they go, oh, okay. That's what he's doing, right?
Yeah, no secrets.
Yeah, there's no secrets. Yeah. And it's like the volume's not super high. It's not like super intense. I'm not doing any wacky exercises. It's like I just kind of show up and do it consistently. And like it works pretty well.
Yeah.
I've no doubt I could get an extra 5% out if I, you know, did more training. But to me, that's not worth the trade-off. I'd rather put that energy somewhere else.
Right. What has been the evolution with your training then?
Well, I started out playing rugby, and then it was super hard to keep up with a job. Like, I was getting up at 3:30 some mornings to get in and train people. And, you're finishing training sometimes at 9:30 at night.
Oh, how early were you training people? 5?
Yeah. Oh, I had one dude.
What savage wants to train at 5?
Dude, this one. Yeah, but this is it. This is the guy who thrives on the 80-hour work week. I just love being at the office kind of thing. And he was just like, I don't care what it costs. Like, I just need to be there at 5 because I start in the office at 6:30.
You still coach this guy?
No way.
Okay.
There's no way.
Is he still alive? Or you...
Yeah, who knows? I hope so. But, like, I mean, he's dead set. He shows up on 3 hours of sleep. He's like, yeah, let's do it.
Fuck.
Like, fuck, man.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, you know, you're doing that. And then, so I was doing a bit of rugby and that sort of stuff and just kind of moved more into, was more interested in, like, strength. So, I was doing more, like, powerlifting and that kind of thing, just a bit casually. And then just kind of transitioned into more physique stuff, bodybuilding, that kind of thing. But honestly, it's just, to me, it's pretty boring, to be perfectly honest. And
the physique part is sad things.
Physique, even, honestly, I find strength sports kind of boring.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really care if people are posting their deadlifts and stuff up. It's like, it's cool if you like it, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I can make people good at it and all that sort of stuff. I know all the principles behind it and I'm invested in someone who I know who's doing it. But when I realized when I was like scrolling on Instagram or something and all I was seeing was like, 180 for 3, RPE 8. I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Well, how is this interesting to anybody?
Yeah, yeah.
So to me, I kind of just found I was doing the same movement all the time. And all of a sudden it was like, if I wanted to go for a jog, it felt awful. Mm. If I wanted to play a round of tennis, just jump in randomly, it felt awful.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't move properly and all this sort of stuff. And so I just kind of realized that, like, for the stuff that I want to do, where I want to be generally pretty good at everything, I still love the feeling of being big. Like, I'm not at my biggest at the moment, but I'm like bigger than the average person. I love the
absolutely
feeling.
Yeah. No doubt.
Like, I love that feeling of being, having a lean physique and having big muscles and the feeling of the pump and all that. It feels fantastic. Like, I love that.
Mm. Yeah.
But at the same time, I want to be able to, like, jump in on a game of whatever, or like go for a swim or a surf and not feel like, holy shit, I'm going to injure myself here.
Yeah, yeah.
And so for me, the priorities just changed because I was never going to compete. And to push myself super hard to get an extra like 5% size that really didn't matter and the average person couldn't tell the difference anyway.
Right.
To me was not, you know, I had to really sit back and go, holy shit, this has been my identity for a long time. And
how long?
like, I really had this epiphany maybe 2 years ago. I was really bored with training.
Mm.
I was still doing it, but I actually couldn't wait to get out of the gym and finish my training session.
Mm.
And so that was probably, I think I would have started training in the gym when I was like 16. And so it would have been like a solid sort of 13, 14 years of training with weights, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just interesting how that's all kind of evolved.
So did you have to then take time off? Like, when you got really bored, like, what was the transition out of that?
I did basically the bare minimum to try and maintain everything. And that's when I realized, like, oh shit, you can actually, if you know what you're doing, you can do like not that much and maintain what you got. Like, it's actually amazing how little you can do.
How little were you doing?
So if we talk, you know, a lot of people are talking about how much volume do I need to grow and all this sort of stuff. And a lot of people are saying, oh, well, the more volume you do and you should do 20 sets a week per body part or whatever. And it's like, man, you know, like probably my quads are like my strongest body part. And like, if I take pictures, it's going to be of my quads because it looks the most impressive out of anything I have. And so people will be like, oh, what's your leg training routine? I'm like, man, I do maybe like 6 to 8 sets a week on them.
Yeah.
And they're like, that can't be right.
Yeah.
Well, it is.
Yeah.
Sorry to burst your bubble, but that's all I was doing. And like my sessions, some sessions were half an hour long, you know? Whereas people are thinking like you got to spend an hour and a half in the gym or 2 hours to get the amount of volume you need to do and all this sort of stuff. So it was kind of surprising. And like, I don't doubt that there's some people who just respond well, better to training than others, you know?
For sure.
But yeah, to me, it was like more about skills based. So like I mentioned my wife before, she's doing some programming for me for calisthenic stuff. So I tend to still, I really like leg training. So I still do more bodybuilding style leg training. But she does my upper body stuff, which is all calisthenic style stuff, which I'm shit at. And it's cool to walk into a gym and like look at your program and go, I don't actually really know what most of this stuff is. Like, this is what it feels like to be most people going to the gym.
Right.
And so that's been a really fun challenge. And I think the difference doing that kind of thing is that you're working towards executing a skill. And to get there, like the difference between someone bench pressing, you know, who's 6 months into training and someone who's elite level is like, yes, there are some technical differences, like no doubt. But fundamentally, it's like weight on the bar is the main difference. Yeah. Whereas for something like calisthenics, for me to do something that an advanced person is doing, I've got to learn like 15 new exercises along the way, which is, I think, really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because like, the skill is for a lot of them, like say for handstand, for example, most people can relate to it. It's like, zero, like one or zero, like you either have it or you don't.
Yeah, totally.
It's like yes or no. I mean, like, there's obviously the in-between moments, but like if the standard really should be a handstand is like you kick up and you hold it.
Yes.
Like you're like, hey guys, I'm holding my handstand like nice and tight and straight. And like for most people, they just don't have that. It's like it's a long accumulation, but to get there, it's like the amount of stuff that you have to do is crazy, from like wrist drills to finger strength to like, you know, even some of the drills we did. Remember Yami took us through those drills in LA where we had to like catch the ball with different hands? Like we were doing brain training drills and then we'd kick up and we had better balance and stuff.
Cool.
Like just really nuts stuff like that. There's so much that goes into a skill like that, which it's completely different.
It's more like a video game. It's like if you like unlock different levels, you're like,
And that's the language they use as well. Like when my wife's in all this like movement world and they'll go, oh, have you got your straddle, like, whatever yet? It's like, have you got it yet? You know, it's like, have you unlocked it yet? You know what I mean? It's like,
what
it's
level handstand master?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's cool. Like, so I don't know. I'm enjoying that stuff at the moment. And that's kind of my evolution of training, I guess.
Yeah, I think as well, it's cool to be able to progress out of the different fields and into other ones and seeing how much what you just did will translate to the next thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like for CrossFit, I think like definitely what didn't help was the amount of injuries we carried over into whatever we're doing next. So it kind of meant that, all right, well, I can't do as much sport as I'd like to right now because my knee's really bad. So I'm doing a lot of knee rehab stuff. But then at the same time, it's like, okay, all the basic movements that were kind of foundations of bodybuilding and powerlifting, you see, and bench pressing, that sort of stuff, because you do them at such a high level in CrossFit with such high repetitions and you need, well, most people don't understand this, but you need extremely good form to do it under high fatigue for so many reps. Mm. So you work form all the time. Like you're trying to get, you know, minor improvements in your rack position
every little
to
bit,
get all the efficiencies because like I don't want to burn any extra energy because this shit is about to hurt really bad and if I'm spilling energy out here, then if I'm squatting too deep or like my squat position's not perfect, then or my rack position's down a little bit, it's going to tax my core, that's going to affect my toes to bar, whatever. Totally. So you're trying to get all these like tiny efficiencies, and then it goes to a bicep curl and it's like, I can smash this now. Like before, I was like not really paying attention to it, but now like I really understand mechanically like how to take the most advantage of this, or when like this weight's just too heavy.
Yep.
You know, because in that sort of stuff, in bodybuilding and powerlifting, it is always like a huge ego hit to go down on the weight.
Totally, yeah.
Whereas in CrossFit, it's like the weight's just set. So it's like, all right, today you're just doing a lightweight, or today you could be doing a heavyweight. It's not always as much about being stronger, or you know, it is, it's part of it, but it's not always about more weight on the bar,
which, yeah,
you
know, totally.
It was really interesting how it translates. But yeah, with the calisthenic stuff, like not much really translates over to it. There's a little bit of stuff, but it's very difficult. It's its whole world. I think it translates most to most other things, that body weight strength, because most people don't have it. Most gymnasts are pretty capable of a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is exploring different movement patterns and learning how to control yourself in different positions. I think that's like a really big thing. So if you can have that, you can take that into a lot of, you know, random movements, I guess.
Yeah.
You've kind of seen it before, so to speak. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And what I find now, like kind of sidestepping into the trainer world, is because I train at the Globo gym now, I don't train at my own gym. I do sometimes, but my coaches know what they're doing, so that's fine. But then I go and I see all these other coaches, and I'm still like looking at them thinking, fuck, do you actually have any idea what you're doing? Like, you're doing, getting this girl to do like crazy drop sets of like tricep pushdowns. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, she doesn't need to do like insane drop sets on the pushdown. Like, I reckon he put the pin down like 8 times. Like, she probably did, he was counting down from like 8 each time. So she did at least 50 reps. And like, she's really overweight, and like, she's got so many different issues. I'm like, dude, she doesn't need to be doing this drop set. You're dealing with like, I don't know what level of training you're dealing with. I assume they've kind of done a little bit more work to have to kind of discover you, to learn your stuff. They're not generally fresh out of school. But what do you think are still some of the major things like our industry needs to like help with this side of the industry with? Like, what are they struggling
with? Well, I mean, what you just described is really typical. And I think it's a difficult thing, because sometimes you can be between a rock and a hard place, where as a trainer, you know that people don't need to do that stuff, or like some trainers know that. But as a client, they're kind of expecting to get whipped into shape, so to speak. And so it's a really challenging thing with some people to give them what they need and still make them feel like they're working hard. Because I think the psychology is the whole missing piece, and how you teach your clients and how you explain to them and the language you use and all that sort of stuff. So let me give you a weird random example is like on pain. So we know a lot about pain now that we didn't know before, where a lot of our experience of pain is not mechanically based. It's not a biology thing. It's not necessarily like this muscle is torn and that's giving you your pain. A lot of it is psychological, and it's your total stress load, and it's how you perceive pain, and it's how you perceive yourself. And so when people come in and you're using language like, you have a muscular imbalance, or don't do it that way, you might hurt yourself, or like, this is the only correct way of doing something, or there's tons of different ways you can use that language, you create this perception in that person that then actually makes them more likely to get pain if they don't move that particular way, or if they do something that you told them not to do, or whatever it is, or the way they perceive themselves, like, I'm fragile now, I've got this muscular imbalance. So the way you deliver that information to them is really, really important, and you can't underestimate the effect that you have on people's psychology with the way you present info to them. So sometimes you're getting them to do the exact same thing, but the way that it's presented and coached is like the key. That's what makes a really good coach. So for me, to give you a solid example of how I might use that with a client, like, I hate over-cueing people. It's something that I don't like. I use as few cues as possible to get them to execute a movement well. Because I feel that if you overload them with information, they don't do it that well, that I just don't learn. But also, you create this like weird dependency on all of those cues when they kind of might have been able to figure it out themselves just by moving, you know what I mean? So something like that, which is not something that is easily it's not super objective, you know what I mean? It's like really difficult to kind of categorize that and go like, this is good coaching and this is bad coaching, because it kind of depends on the individual and what you're trying to do. But I think that that's probably where a lot of the industry is going wrong, is that they get a little bit too hung up on like, this is correct, this is incorrect. You know, this is like a hard line that you have to, you can't cross this line or whatever it is. And the reality is that what we're trying to do is we're trying to find, like we spoke about, that balance and that middle ground, and just getting people to where they need to go, and being a bit ambivalent as to what the exact technique is that you do it. It's like, you can't just there's stuff that works for most people. You know, if you have someone come in and you've seen somebody similar to that 1,000 times before, you kind of go, okay, I've seen this before. I know roughly what to do and it'll probably work. But at the same time, you can't just do the same thing for everybody and expect exactly the same result. It's kind of got to be a little bit more tailored that way. And I think that's the really challenging part. Mm. So, you know, I suppose that's a kind of a bit of a convoluted and a bit of a weird explanation.
That makes sense. Yeah.
But, you know, that's where I see a lot of coaches fall down, is that they get a little bit too locked into, like, what's the takeaway from this article? You know, you have to squat ass to grass. Like, that's now the rule and that's what they do with everybody.
Right.
And it's like all the context is lost.
And do you have techniques then with the way you describe it that gets people to? Because often I find like beginners are not as good as more experienced athletes with just dealing with the discomfort of pain.
Yeah.
So like maybe changing their... You know, it's kind of like, I think sometimes when you're like, hey, you know, you do this, your legs are going to start burning, and that's really good. That means like you're killing this exercise. It changes their perception around it.
And I think that's where the knowledge of the biochem and all of that comes in as well, because you can go like, you know, if someone's going, oh, you know, inflammation and this and that, and you go, oh, well, actually, inflammation is part of how cells, that's how cells communicate to each other, and it's part of the adaptive process of muscle growing. So we kind of actually want some inflammation there.
Mm.
If we get rid of that inflammation, your muscles don't get the signal that they need to grow.
Mm.
And then they kind of go like, ah, cool. I'll embrace that sort of thing. So I think that really helps. Like having the ability to back up what you're talking about and go, well, actually, I know a little bit how the body works. And so this is why it's working. You give them that confidence in themselves and in you as a coach as well. That's really important to me, that I'm able to explain that to them. And the thing is that if you know that background behind everything, you can take those principles and you can apply it to so many situations. There's not just like a rule book of like, if X, then Y. It's like, I know the principle behind this. I've got to create a calorie deficit with this person for them to lose fat. Okay, there's 3 million ways I can do that with someone.
Right.
It's not a case of like, well, everybody who comes in, I've got to put them on low carb or I've got to put them on paleo or whatever. Well, everybody's situation is just slightly different in terms of context. Mm. I can take that principle of generating a calorie deficit. One person I can get to track because they do really well on that. One person I can get to go paleo because they do really well on that. One person can go keto. One person can literally take pictures of their food and send it to me because it stops them from being a dickhead and like eating chocolate because they know I'm going to get on their case about it, you know? So that's, I think, where it comes in. It's like, that's why the knowledge and the principles are so important as well. Mm. Yeah.
So with all that being said, it seems like the next frontier that we all have to face is we want to do it, you know, in an online context, and you're doing it at the moment, right? Which makes it very difficult because there's such a human element to all the stuff you just mentioned. So how do you increase adherence and how do you get this coaching across in an online format?
Yeah, that's the big challenge. Like the online thing is super hard, right? So for me, my goal as a coach is to be a mix between hands off and giving the client self-efficacy and being able to kind of take control of them, of their own training. I don't want them to rely on me forever. Like I think it's kind of shit if someone has to stop training with me for whatever reason, and then like maybe I see them 3 months later, I'm like, hey, how's training going or eating or whatever, and they're like, well, I kind of fell off because I didn't know what to do. Like that's not good. That's really bad. You want to teach them stuff. But at the same time, I don't want to be an overbearing coach. Like I said, with like over-cueing, for example, you know, if you're giving people like 6 cues for every single rep that they do, like it's too much. And they can't get out of that. Like, well, I need to rely on this guy to tell me all this shit every time. Otherwise, I'm going to do it wrong. So it's kind of a mix with online of trying to get them to work out what's working well for them and understand when they've won and understand, self-reflective and understand where they could improve. But at the same time, I'm not being overbearing and like every single little thing they do, I'm having to like track and tell them this and tell them that. Right. And that's a really difficult thing to do. So a lot of my process is like we track data, like basic data, like things like weight and how much sleep they're getting and things like that. But my check-ins also involve things like what their mood was like, what they think they've done well for the week, what they think they could have improved, stuff like that. And then I try and give them feedback I actually make videos for my clients. So like every check-in is literally me talking to them physically. Right. And I think that creates a bit more of a connection and allows me to explain things a little bit better that might have lost its context in like a written check-in.
For sure.
So that's like a couple of things that I do. Mm. But I think the challenge is still there with online, where, you know, in person is is pretty much always going to be better, but it's just not feasible for some situations. You know, like obviously I don't coach people in person. So if people want to work with me, it's got to be online.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a tough thing though. I think the online is really difficult and I think we're probably still working out exactly the best way to do it.
I think everyone is, right?
Yeah.
I think because the industry is the biggest dilemma for a lot of people is they don't want to have to wake up early mornings every day. Some people do. They're psychotic, but or they're just young. And they want to, you know, find a way to continue to coach, which is their passion, and help people, but not have to do the exact work schedule that exists for the personal trainer. Because in a way, and this is the issue that we've had with some of our coaches, is that they find they're almost a little bit isolated socially because like they work and then they're free all through the day, which is great. You can take selfies on the beach, but you're by yourself because unless you hang out with other fitness industry people, but most likely your roommates are like from, you know, finance or, you know, some other industry, maybe you're creative and, you know, your schedules are so different and it's like, oh guys, I can't come out to dinner. I got to wake up early. Right. And so eventually they feel the pressure and like, how many PTs do you know that, or how many people do you know that were PTs at some point? You're like, oh, you were a PT. Why'd you stop? Oh, I just didn't want to do early mornings. Or like, it didn't work out for me. So the most viable option is to go online, but it's also tough. It also has its own challenges, which is some of the stuff you just mentioned. How many coaches now, because, you know, you are doing some of this with these coaches, how many of them are trying to push online?
I would say almost every coach I've ever met is trying to get more online.
Right. For those reasons, you find?
Probably for those reasons, for the flexibility. I think it's... Honestly, it's harder work than most people realize. I think to for a couple of reasons. The first is that, obviously, you're not in front of people. So, you know, like my tip is if you're a new trainer and you're at some kind of... any gym, like literally just being seen, being the guy who says hello to people, that kind of thing, will get you more clients than any Facebook ad you can ever put out. You know what I mean? So there's that challenge of like getting high quality clients and getting them consistently online and being able to get good results with them is really, really hard. But I think the back end work that goes into it is like long and slow. And a lot of people kind of just want, they don't realize that your lifestyle is still going to be quite structured, you know? So like I'm still very structured in what I do every day. And it's, I'm actually going traveling. I'm very, very fortunate to be able to be in this position where we're kind of traveling indefinitely. But I understand that, yeah, I'm going to be in Portugal, but like 90% of the days there, I'm going to be sitting at a computer, you know, still doing the same thing. And honestly, I think a lot of coaches get into the online thing and then they realize like, actually, the reason I got into this business is because I am a people person and I like being able to interact with people.
Right.
And I like being able to like pretty much, not that you never have contact with your in-person clients, but like when you finish a session, you've kind of done your job and it's done. You don't necessarily have to take that much home with you. Whereas if you're online, you're kind of always online. You're kind of always doing something and you end up working those big weeks and all that sort of stuff. But I think most trainers do want to get a little bit online because it gives them that flexibility. They don't want to do the early wake-ups. I found that, you know, my friendship groups from high school, I was friends with a lot of different people, different groups in high school because I was a bit of a nerd, but I also played footy and all that sort of stuff. And I barely keep in touch with any, if any of them from school because of that. Like I could never go out because I had to get up to train this dude at 3:30. You know what I mean? And that's really hard. And then you end up getting even more, like you described, you get, you know, fitness pros. And so you get more and more insulated and isolated and you get in this little weird fitness bubble and it's just strange.
The funny thing is I find that when people say they want to go online, often it's really just a code word for I just don't want to work. They're like, oh, I want to do some like online. Like, what do you mean? Oh, you know, like at the beach and stuff. Because it doesn't really make any sense because they got in, they're like, hey, I don't want to like sit at a computer desk. I don't want to sit at a computer at a desk all day. I want to do my passion. What are you doing? Oh, I'm trying to go online. I'm like, also sit at a desk on a computer.
Totally. And that's the irony of it is that, you know, like there's definite downsides to an office job and we've described some of them. But you know you're getting X amount of holiday. You know you got to work X amount of hours in a week. You know you're getting paid X amount and you're going to have some super on top of that. Like, sweet. If when you run your own business, it can be very, very successful, but you always have that fear of like, what if this all just falls over tomorrow? It won't, but you still have that like...
It might.
You know, it could happen. Like, what happens if, you know, if your whatever online portal you use shuts down tomorrow? You know what I mean? Like, all of that sort of stuff. It's a really strange thing to be in. And so, like, a lot of people, will say, like, with my business, obviously you have flexibility and I'm envious of that. And I 100%, I'm unbelievably lucky with the flexibility I've got and the ability to be self-driven and how I do it. But I still work like 70-hour weeks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I still do that. Like, yeah. And I don't necessarily have to. Like, my business is not going to collapse. I could work 10 hours this week and I'd be okay. But there's always that, like, but I've got to keep working towards something in the future. There's no boundary there. There's no, like, well, this is the what you have to finish this week and then you're done sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you're totally right. Like, the online thing is probably a lot more glamorous than it seems.
And for sure.
To that point as well, though, I think a lot of in-person trainers are a bit silly with how they set up their days and they'll go, oh, I'll work a 12-hour day today. It's like, nah, dude, you booked two people before work and you booked two people after work and you did fuck all in between. Yeah, That's not a 12-hour work day.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to get smarter about that. Like, you can do four-hour day. Yeah, you can be finished by 10 a.m. if you were smart about it.
Yeah,
you
know?
So I think that's another aspect of it where it's like maybe just refining your in-person business would actually give you more flexibility.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I also think that a lot of, because the industry is so young, the fitness industry, you know, for lots of reasons, but if there is no established best practices yet, like there is in accounting or science, you know, it's like there's a lot of stuff that we still need to figure out. And I think, you know, a big issue is that we started fitness in terms of what people are paying for it, the general public, is it's just way too cheap.
Yeah.
It's just way too cheap. They're just, most people think that $30 a week for a gym membership is a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, well, actually that is like sort of the bare minimum. And that's just to have access to, that's just kind of like your entry fee, totally. You know? And now you've got to pay for like all this different coaching on top. And by the time it adds up to an amount that people would actually value and get benefit from, they don't want to pay that much. Yeah. They want to pay $30. But we've just kind of fucked up from the start as to like how we price things, and now we're kind of undoing it. And I think that, you know, $100 a week for online coaching, I'm like, well, that seems reasonable. If anything, you know, for a guy like you who's got this experience, you know, really people should be paying like $200 a week or a percentage of their income, because then you're delivering better results. So I think we're still trying to figure out how to scale it, how to have it, you know, financially make sense, because there are a lot of coaches that I know that are really good that don't make any money. And I think that's a little bit sad as well. And, you know, you probably saw the situation unfold a little bit at the gym you were at previously, where those people were kind of out of the job all of a sudden. Like, that's really rough, just like that, you know? Yeah. And it's just kind of like, yes, it makes the industry really tough and it keeps a lot of good people out of it as well.
It does, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing as well, though. You also get like these coaches who... So I could charge probably double what I charge, but I want to make it accessible to the right people. And it's like that coaching relationship can be so fulfilling if you have the right person, the right partnership. And like, there's tons of people who have the money to pay me whatever I want to, whatever I ask of them, they'll pay me. But we won't be a good fit. I won't get them good results because we're not a good fit.
Right.
And so I think that's a really big piece of the puzzle. And I think a lot of people don't realize that when they're looking for a trainer, it's like, you're not looking for, you know, some people who have the money will go, well, I'll just get the most expensive guy because he's probably the best.
Yeah.
And other people will shop around and go, well, this guy takes $50 cash for an hour session. I'll just go with him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's so much more than that. You got to, you know, it's a partnership.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I agree. It's a bit of a weird industry because like, so that the gym I worked at closed and we had a really nice model there where it wasn't quite a boutique studio type of arrangement. It wasn't a big Globo gym. It was something in between. And there's not a lot of that stuff out there. And as a coach, you can either go into the fitness first of the world where like they try and milk you for every drop they can get out of you. But you also have essentially uncapped potential to earn money there.
Right.
You got to deal with a lot of bullshit and a lot of tire kickers and all that kind of stuff. But you can make a lot of money in that situation. You mean
your peers or the clients?
The clients, right, like, right. You know, if you go to a Fitness First and there's like 2,000 members there, there's a lot of people who are going to do intro sessions with you or whatever, and they're not going to be great clients for you or whatever. Sure. You got to put up with that stuff. If you go to somewhere, like there's a lot of places where they maybe have a nicer clientele for you, but it's they don't pay you very much. They might pay you as a trainer $30 or $40 for a session, and it's like to try and make... it's a very draining profession to be doing like 50 sessions a week so you can make like the money you want to make sort of thing. And so it's really difficult because there's not a lot in between. And so on one end, you've got people who are charging $150 an hour in a Fitness First in the city. And on the other end, you've got people who are getting paid like $40 an hour who are offering probably a service that's almost just as good.
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, that industry is just weird how there's no real standard around it. And yeah. People don't understand what makes a good trainer and what doesn't often.
Yeah. Well, I think we're trying to, at this point, establish that. I think we're trying to create... I know there's been some rumblings of different people starting independent sort of fitness bodies, which are like teaching schools, kind of the stuff that you're doing, so that we can like properly accredit people, so that you can say like, all right, this person's actually worth this much money. You know, it's like they have chartered accountants, right? Yep. They're like, they've gone through the hardest shit to become an accountant. They're legit, so you pay them more money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the fitness industry is just waiting for something like that. It's just going to take some time. And I think also the business model as well for the independent gym, which most people are kind of, they've kind of done fitness first. They kind of know what to expect and they're looking for something else. That particular independent gym, somewhere between 50 to 200 clients, is also trying to figure out what the best business model is, which I think is, it's getting closer. You know, we've obviously had our go at it and stuff, and we think we've got a pretty good model, but you know, we hear different models all the time, every day, and yeah, like it's going to get better. And eventually, you know, I don't know how long it's going to take. It could be next year. It could be in 50 years, 100 years. We could eventually decide on, okay, this is the best way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and the variation is going to be somewhere like 5%, you know, whereas right now they vary so much.
Oh, it's all over the place. Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. Like huge variation. Like Orange Theory is completely different to probably Barry's Bootcamp with how they pay their trainers, right? So, all kinds of stuff right now that we're not sure of. But like most industries, the 1% of the 1% make, you know, a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, absolutely, yeah.
That's
kind of
how...
people out there making ridiculous cash.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. So, look, we ask all our guests four questions. Did you get the four questions?
Yeah, I did, yeah,
All right, perfect. So, you have a podcast. So, if you had an opportunity to invite anyone on that's alive today, who would you choose and why?
I think that would be pretty tough. I got to say, I'm a big music fan, and I don't know how much I would get out of this dude, but I find Maynard, who's the lead singer of Tool,
okay,
I find him pretty interesting. So, he's a bit of a weird dude.
Was he on Joe Rogan's podcast
recently? He was, yeah. So, him and Joe are like kind of buddies, but he's a bit of an odd guy, and he doesn't give too much away. Okay. So, I'm not sure how good that would be, but if you could get something out of him, I think he's fascinating. So,
Why do you think he's fascinating?
Well, I mean... I really like the band and everything they've done, and I really like a lot of his side projects, like super creative and all that stuff. But he also does some really wacky shit. Like, he started a winery in Arizona, which is just like, it's a desert. And, you know, he's kind of like explained the process of, it takes you like 5 years on a block of land to kind of realize if it's going to work or not. So I think that happened, you know, once or twice, and he's like had to move, and it's where he's from. So he wants to make wine from there. Right, and I don't know, it's just like a... He doesn't think like the average person. So I think that would be pretty interesting. There's another dude we spoke a bit. He's not alive anymore, but I think Alan Watts would be pretty interesting. So he's kind of, you know, a guy who popularized a lot of the kind of, I suppose it's like Buddhist type stuff in Western society. But I listened to a few of his speeches and I think he's a interesting guy.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
They're pretty good. Yeah. So I think he would be quite interesting to talk to. So I guess that's my answer. Nice. I'm like... I think a lot of people want to talk to the athletes. Rock. I think The Rock would be cool. I think he's a cool guy. Or like Arnie, I think he would be awesome. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
just because he's successful across a bunch of different things. But a lot of the time, it's kind of like, yeah, man. I mean, he's real good at kicking a ball, but like, is there much else going on there? I kind of want a bit more out of a conversation, you know? So I think those guys would probably provide that.
Alan Watts would be good. He's got some really good stuff. If people haven't seen any Alan Watts' stuff, just go on YouTube, type Alan Watts, and like click the most viewed videos. Some pretty like motivational shit in there.
It's motivational without being like too like
without being obviously
motivational. It's cool.
I've had a few people tell me Alan Watts, not for this question, but they've told me like, you know, oh, you changed or what happened. They're like, dude, I watched an Alan Watts video, like changed my life. I was like, oh shit, okay. And then I started looking. Second question, what is something that you try and do every day that you feel like is essential for the success of the day?
Man, I do, like, I'm pretty routine driven, so there's like a lot of things. I always go for a walk outside for a couple of reasons. Like, I think it's just good from a mental health standpoint, and I try and do some of that without any external stimulus. So I kind of feel that, like, we're always kind of occupying our mind with something. So whether it's listening to a podcast or music or an audiobook or whatever it is, there's kind of no periods of quiet in the mind throughout the day. And I find a lot of people will maybe get home and like the first bit of actual ability to kind of have some introspection is when they go to sleep. And then it's like suddenly your mind's racing. I'm sure like everybody's experienced that, right? You lie there and you're like thinking of all this shit. And sometimes feel really creative when you're in bed. And I think it's just because you haven't had the space to do that throughout the day. So I feel that that's really helpful for me. Obviously, you get the step count up and you get some light into your eyes. So it's good for your circadian rhythm and all that sort of stuff. But I also think just like keeping your mind a bit unoccupied is really good. But I'm really routine driven. Like I kind of set up blocks of time for everything that I do stuff. And like I practice guitar for a certain amount of time a day and I read for a certain amount of time and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, but I think that's probably the one thing that a lot of people would get heaps out of.
How would you how are you going to deal with traveling indefinitely? How are you going to set up? You think you'll feel that's like how do you feel challenge. When you're out of routine? Do you feel like chaotic?
Yeah, but it's good for me, right?
Right,
it's really good for me.
Yeah.
So my wife really laughs at me because like sometimes on Sundays I'm like, I'm going to try not working today. And she just pisses herself at me. It's like, yeah, you should probably do that. And I'm sitting there like, fuck, I'm so bored. I don't know what to do. Yeah, I think it's super good. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge with travel because, like, I still get up pretty early. I'm basically the gym closed and I just stayed on the same schedule. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think the travel is going to be really interesting trying to keep a routine.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's like finding the happy medium, right? I'm probably too far on that curve of like routine. I should probably try and get a little bit more towards center.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sometimes it helps, I find, because you just, you know, you lose your routine and then you find some new things you can add into your routine.
Yeah. And do you know what? I think that's the best thing about travel, right? It's like you get out of your routine and then every like great business decision I've made or like cool idea I've had for like what to do with our fucking lives has been born out of like we've gone traveling. It's jolted you out of your routine. You see some different stuff and then you're like thinking a bit differently and being creative. And I think that's awesome.
So. Yeah. I think the routine is good for productivity, but I think for new creativity, it is limiting.
100%.
You know, I was actually listening to something interesting. I was actually telling you about it. Esther Perel. Do you know Esther Perel?
Yeah.
She's like relationship therapist, sex coach. And she was talking about, there was this one particular episode I was listening to on her podcast. They're like live therapy sessions of different couples.
That's right. Yeah. I haven't listened to that, but I've heard about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's called like, Where Should We Start? Or Where Do We Start? Or something.
That's it. Yeah.
Anyway, so she's talking to this couple and their sex life is just like basically non-existent, right? Mm. And they're talking about how they can't get intimate with each other and like they can't even hug. She's like, cool, we're going to start with a hug. They can't hug. It's so funny.
Whoa.
And so it's like completely gone. And it happened when, like, it basically started once they had their first kid. Mm. They've had like 3 kids since. So it's been like this stretch of like, whatever, 4 years, 5 years or something where they haven't like touched each other, but they want to, but they just can't. And she was saying that. And, you know, most people, if I ask you right now, like, well, okay, so they had the kids, so why do you think it was? Like, oh, you know, it's because they had the kids. Everyone says, you know, yeah, we had the kids and we stopped being intimate and we stopped liking each other and that's where all the shit falls apart. And she was saying that from all her research and what she's done is actually has nothing to do with the kids. What is the reason that the intimacy goes away is because of the routine. Mm. And she says that routine is the absolute killer of intimacy because once you have a kid, you need more routine than you've ever had in your life because it's so chaotic now, right? Because you're trying to calm the chaos. And so you do that by like, all right, you wake up at this time, they have the bottle by this time, you do this thing, do this, do that. I get home from work, you know, we do 20 minutes here, we do 15 minutes there, put them into bed. Because it is this like, the baby has to get fed every hour and a half. So it's like this insane routine. And because they kept it up, obviously, for 3 kids, which is not uncommon for a lot of people, is that it kills intimacy. And I just can't tell you the amount of stories that, you know, you've probably heard as well from different clients is same thing. It's like the relationship is the first thing to go once you have kids. And she says it starts with the intimacy, but it's brought on by the routine, not because of the kid. It has nothing to do with the kid. I've always thought that was what it was. It was the kid. And I was like, wow, it does make sense. Is that routine can be a killer of a lot of different things that you don't even realize, but you trade it because it's so good for other things.
Yeah.
So I think it's good to like break down, you know, a current routine and rebuild a new one, which is why I like changing environments. Like we've done, I don't know how many podcast studio changes we've done in the last few years, but each time we do it, it's kind of like we reset and it kind of goes to like this different level and it changes and stuff, which is super important.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I like that.
And like when people change jobs or they move houses, I'm like, dude, this is like the perfect time. Awesome. You can reset heaps of shit now. You know, every time you sat on that couch and like you ate Cheetos and you were on your phone for 4 hours every night, like your brain, your subconscious mind is just like, boom.
You got that association.
Yeah, you sit down, you're just like, cool, where's my Cheetos? And like, where's my phone? Yeah. And you don't even realize it. You're on full autopilot right now. So when you can reset that environment, like we're huge on that. Like the book Atomic Habits, I don't know if you've read it, but that was like when I started reading that, I basically turned every section of my apartment into like a very specific thing.
Cool.
So like it, I had very strict rules. So if I sat at that desk, you know, to do work, it was only work. No phone, no reading, no food, like nothing. It just was work. And then after probably, I don't know, a month of doing that, every time I sat down there, it's like, I just went, it was so easy to work. Yeah. I was like, wow, this is like effortless. And I was like, oh, that's because you're not like disrupting all your subconscious behaviors.
Yeah.
And like the only place that was had kind of a mix of different activities was the couch. And so it's because I would like take a nap there, but then I would also read there. Sometimes I'd eat there. So I did find that when I would sit down on the couch sometimes, if the last seven times had been a nap, I'm like, oh, I'm so tired.
Yeah.
Because your body's like, oh, fuck, it's the nap. And I think the one people relate to most is they walk into the bathroom, they don't have to pee. Maybe they forgot something. And they're like, they see the toilet, they're like, oh, I gotta pee.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's just subconscious behavior, like just kicks in. Like it's so strong.
Yeah.
It's crazy. We have no control over it. It's,
Yeah, that's nuts. Massive. That's really powerful. That's actually one of the things I do for sleep as well. Like I get people to just beds like sleep only.
Right.
If you find you can't sleep, like if you're tossing and turning a bit, like get out of the bed, get away from the bed, let the sleep pressure build up a little bit and then have another go. Because it just helps to program your brain that like that's where you sleep. It's not where you think.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, the thing you were saying before as well, I don't know if you've done much of the research in the or looked at some of the stuff they're bringing out now for the default mode network, which is that area in your brain.
Yeah,
and it's like for people who don't know, maybe you can maybe explain this better than me, but in fMRI studies, they've looked at this small area of the brain. It's kind of theoretical right now, but like it's becoming more mainstream. This area of the brain lights up when you do have downtime, when you're becoming introspective, and that's like what they're kind of deciding is the area that controls the ego. So it's how you place yourself in the world, like what you've done previously, what you're about to do, and it either contribute to feelings of depression and anxiety. But what's interesting about meditation and like other stuff, like using psychedelic drugs, is you limit or you turn off the default mode network, and you're able to kind of use that kind of stoic principles we talked about, is like looking at things more objectively, and rather than looking how everything is like, you know, sabotaging me, or how I fucked up this, I fucked up that, or I'm useless this. It's just like, how is all this stuff happening around me and how am I going to interpret it?
Yeah.
Which is one of the more like scientific benefits of meditation. Totally. I think that, when people are not, when they're getting very brief moments with their kind of default mode network and they're not kind of controlling it, is when it caused a lot of issues for a lot of people.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay. How was my explanation?
That was cool. Yeah, that was good.
Sweet. A+.
That's great. Yeah.
So third question is, what is something recently you changed your mind on that you held for a while as a strong belief?
I don't know if there's like anything big. I always think about this, but I think it's more a case of like ideas evolve over time, right? So that's probably really my answer, I guess, is that everything kind of iterates on itself a little bit. And I think probably where I am, I always look back and because I'm actively involved in trying to improve myself and what I'm doing, if you look back and do these small things every day and you change slowly, it's a lot like a weight loss diet or building muscle or getting better at something. It's, you look back 6 months ago and you go, holy shit, I've actually come a really long way. Or like my ideas have changed a lot from like 2 or 3 years ago. But it's just like little iterations over time.
Yeah.
It's probably the biggest thing. But I think like I've gotten a lot more into this whole, I suppose just pursuing other areas of life outside of fitness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But recognizing that they're all kind of blends together. It's they're all intertwined somehow. That's probably the biggest thing, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be interesting. Later today, we've got a conversation with Ben Pekulski.
Oh, cool. Yeah, yeah.
And I think he's been a really big version of that, right? He's been on the Olympia stage to like now he's like the bodybuilding yogi, right? It's like,
yeah. Totally. I chatted to him recently and he was just saying like he was actually really good at separating himself. I mean, he'll probably talk about it, but separating himself from like identifying as a bodybuilder.
Right.
He still found himself distinct from that. And I think that's maybe something that I've also come to realize, because when I first was like, kind of finding like, oh shit, I'm getting a bit bored of weights. Oh my God. Like, you know, you do have that identity associated with lifting weights or looking a certain way for sure.
Right.
And it's very difficult to like put that aside.
Right.
So that's kind of a lesson, I guess, I'm taking forward into other stuff. You know, it's and it like jumping back to the pain stuff as well. It's like identifying yourself as like, you know, I am someone with lower back pain or whatever it is. Right. It's like just thinking of yourself as distinct from that can actually make a really big difference in how you experience it. So, yeah, that's like a pretty interesting thing. I think you get a lot out of that with Ben.
Well, I think
yeah.
It's harder to pull it away in fitness than anything else, because if you're like, whatever, you're really into surfing, you're like, hey, I want to like broaden my perspective. You go meet somebody, they're not straight away like, oh, cool. So like, how's your surfing going? Whereas if you like, walk around like a bodybuilder, it's like the second he walks in, anyway, they're like, oh, so you're bodybuilding. Like, how's
exactly.
How's your bodybuilding going, bodybuilder?
Yeah. It's funny because especially when, we spoke about how you get into this fitness bubble and people just talk about fitness and it's like, dude, to be perfectly honest, I'm really bored of bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to talk about this at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting that way.
Man, yeah, that the change, like not associating your body with your identity is huge.
It's,
I think
it's so hard. But it's huge.
I've sort of come to the conclusion that I don't think the insecurities, because I grew up super skinny, and I've talked about this on the podcast all the time, but you know, I can just, you know, wear the wrong shirt at the wrong time of day and look in the mirror and be like, dude, it's like you've never lifted a weight in your life. And so you have to accept, I've sort of accepted that it's always there. I don't think it can go away, because if it would have gone away, it would have gone away, you know, 10, 15 kilos ago, but it doesn't, you know, because objectively it's been 30 kilos on paper, but you still feel like the guy who never lifted weights. So it's like, you have to just learn to deal with it. You know, the feeling comes up and it's like, that's not me.
Totally agree with you. Cause even like, I don't view myself as particularly muscly or big,
right?
To the average person, I am.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, people would say, oh, this guy's a freak.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I get that sometimes. I'm kind of like, I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I did have some lower back pain at some point, and I went and got treated by a chiro and stuff, and he was going, like, I said, oh, yeah, you know, like I deadlifted 180 today or whatever. And I was like, in my world, that's not good.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, that's fantastic. That's amazing, mate. And I was like, dude, there's girls that are lifting that much in my gym. Like, you have no idea. I'm surrounded by like these elite lifters, and it just distorts your perception of like what is reality. I think you're right. It doesn't go away. You got to learn to deal with that.
Absolutely. And final question is, do you have a book or a quote recommendation?
I got a quote. Okay. I got to pull it out. Let me bring it up
here. Well, what's your favorite fantasy series or book?
That is pretty tough. I really like Patrick Rothfuss. His book is called The Name of the Wind.
Okay.
It's very good. I've read quite a lot. I think the first one that really pulled me in was a book called Magician by Raymond E. Feist. Feast. I'm not really sure how to pronounce it. That was really good.
Okay.
That kind of really sucked me in. I've been reading fantasy from when I was a kid.
Right.
And that stuff's always kind of fascinated me. So
yeah.
I think that's all pretty cool.
What was the one Kelly Surratt brought up for us? June or something?
June. Oh, yeah, June. Frank Herbert. June. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, that's really good.
That one's sitting on the bookshelf. I got to read
that one. Yeah, that's like, so that was written in like the 60s. It's like classic. Okay. It's like one of those, you got to read this.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I really like that. Like, there's another series called The Wheel of Time by Robert Jordan, which is like really popular. And I think it's 14 books long or something. Like, it's massive.
That's a commitment.
Yeah, but like about 7 books in, I'm just going like, he's got these like, same phrases that he tends to use, and you get so familiar with the writing. But at that point, I was just like, I can't keep doing this. You feel like I need to finish this series, but I just couldn't do it. So I never got through it all.
Maybe that's the thing. It's the wheel of time. Like, you can't get off the wheel.
Fucked. It feels like you're reading it
the
forever.
14th book, there's no words in it.
It's just
the same word.
Oh, dude. So this is Teddy Roosevelt, a quote. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. That's probably my favorite quote.
That's one of the best.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's really good. Yeah.
Man, someone recently on a podcast as well read it out. I can't remember.
Really?
Who. Yeah.
Yeah, it's killer. I posted it up on my social media and everyone was like, I have that on my wall. Yeah. It's the best thing ever. Yeah, I think it's really cool.
Yeah. The I mean, the main message, I mean, I think what's good about a quote like that is everyone hears something different, right? So everyone's interpretation of it is a little bit different. Like, how do you interpret it?
I think for me, it's just on a personal level, it's really about just putting myself out there, and it's kind of better to so it goes into this other quote that I think was attributed to John F. Kennedy, which he said, "Things don't happen; things are made to happen." And for me, I've always felt like I've been a little bit too in my head, a little bit, you know, like a bit of an academic, and a bit, I kind of want to be out there a bit more and make things happen and pull things closer to me rather than wait for them to arrive.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Hence why we're going traveling. Hence why I got this tattoo like 2 weeks ago.
Oh yeah, right.
You know what
yeah,
I mean?
It's cool tattoo.
Stuff like yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Nearly completely healed now. Yeah, you know, so that's kind of what I take out of it, is that especially in the age of social media, I feel like there's a lot of criticism out there, but not a lot of, like, you know, let's stop throwing stones in glass houses. You
yeah,
know
what yeah. I mean?
Like, I would rather think the best of someone and think that they have good intentions behind what they're trying to do, and they're trying to do something, than to just pull people down without doing anything myself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's kind of what I take out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the whole message, I think, for me has always been, it's like, it's not really ever about the result. It's yeah. always about the process.
It's the process,
always
yeah.
about trying. It's always about just like doing something you enjoy. And because I think for us, we've always, you know, achieved certain results, and it doesn't always make you feel the way you thought you would feel.
No, that's very, very true.
And then you realize, yeah. It's like, it's about trying. It's about the process.
I'm very big on process orientation.
Yeah.
Really into that. And, you know, when I went on this kick of like what makes people happy and better people and all that sort of stuff, I think that's the resounding message, is that like whenever you arrive somewhere, you're always looking to the horizon again. You're never satisfied with it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't know, you don't believe them until you get there and you're like, fuck.
Yeah, that's
you're right.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's, I think that's always been a tough thing, is like, you do really have to enjoy the process,
yeah.
because if you don't, the reward is only very short-lived.
Yes.
You know, and then also, you may not even get the reward because it might not actually be worth it. Like,
yeah.
you might find that, oh shit, this is nothing like what I expected.
Yeah.
So, for us, yeah, process is really big. And I think even with training, you know, hearing you talk about getting bored with it or whatever, and then you explored a different path, because ultimately, you still wanted the result, right? You still want to be muscular.
Sure.
You still want to be lean. And then you explore a different journey to achieve the same result.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, sick. Because now I'm enjoying the process
yeah.
and it's not what I thought it had to be.
Yeah.
And I'm achieving the result I want.
That's right. Yeah. Often the result is kind of the side effect of the process, right?
Yeah.
Rather than being the end goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Raph, you got the floor to how you interpret that quote. I feel it'd be wrong if I didn't ask you.
Well, generally, this quote comes up when some sportsman's just got really pissed off about a critic. And it's actually funny because it's really famous critic, and they're like, no, they never make statues about critic, but anyway, they made a statue of this critic outside a very famous football ground.
Yeah.
But it is a good one, but I think the reality is that people always like to use it in that circumstance, but everybody's, the thing they're doing really is the arena they're in.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like unfair sometimes how people put it, but yeah. wherever you're in, like, that is your arena.
Yes.
And you just gotta, I think the Aussie way to say it, you just gotta have a dig.
Yeah.
You know, wherever you're at.
Totally. Mm. Yeah. I'm on board with that.
And then what is the, did we get, I mean, I've read some fantasy books, but any other influential books that you feel like to share with the listeners?
Let me think. There's a few things that have been written by a few different people just on the, I think on consciousness, which I'm really interested in, especially having a little bit of a neuroscience background. I feel like it's really interesting to me. Like Sam Harris has written some stuff. Steven Pink has written some stuff. There's another guy whose name I'm blanking on, but his book was about the nature of reality as well. And I find all of that stuff really, really interesting. Not that I agree with everything that those guys say, but
yeah.
I think that's been quite influential, just kind of understanding how much our reality is a product of our perception.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like my reality is different to yours, and the way the world appears to, I don't know, a dog is completely different because our sensory organs are different, and that's
right.
kind of it. Like, we don't really know for sure.
Yeah,
I suppose
yeah.
it gets very philosophical, and it gets into that whole thing of ego and the default mode network, and you know, there's some interesting stuff with, I suppose, psychedelic substances where that can be dissolved a little bit and you can kind of get a little bit outside of that, and it can happen with meditation and stuff as well. The whole concept of free will coming out of that, do we really have free will? Does it matter? I don't think we do.
Mm.
But at the same time, it's not going to feel like we don't have free will. So is that, does it matter or not? All of that's kind of just really made me think and question about how I perceive things. I think it has practical applications. It's not just like really esoteric. It's also, you know, how you communicate with people, how you deal with certain situations, like we've spoken about, kind of trying to just pull back for a second and trying to see things objectively because of that. So that's had some practical implications for my life as well and how I react to situations and stuff like that. So
nice.
You should write that book in regards to training. I feel like there's a one in there. It's like, you know, we always talk about like, what is it like to train?
Yeah.
Because it is pretty confusing, right? If you're trying to describe someone, hey, what's it like to do a hard session? Oh, well, you just kind of know on the inside some shit's fucked and you
yeah,
can't even see your leg, but you know something is burning.
And
I don't know, it is interesting.
It's super interesting. You know, and the psychology of performance as well comes into that, right? Like I've had clients where I do the old, you put a bunch of weight on the bar and they don't know what's on there and they deadlift a 20 kilo PB because they didn't know what was on there. You know what I mean? For one example. So, yeah, it's fascinating.
It's hard to, like, it's like, what's the difference between leg extensions and, like, burning your knee on a stove?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's, like, hard to describe it. Totally. But you're like, man, one is, like, awesome, one sucks.
Exactly. No, you're right. You're totally right. It's pretty interesting, hey?
Or even just how people, like, I know we're at the end here, but we're still going on tangents. Yeah. But even people's how, like, I was actually hearing, I think it was Ben Pokulski talk about, when he gets to the hardest part in the set, what he tries to do is he always tries to laugh or smile, because what he's doing is trying to hack his nervous system and his dopamine release and his experience of that pain, so that when he gets to that pain, he actually wants to get there. His body is trying to get there because it's an enjoyable state. And it makes you think, like, with a lot of these people that are like really extreme at their sports, for example, is that I reckon something's happened to them in early childhood where they've experienced a really high level of pain, which most people would turn away from. 99.9% of people do, but they had some weird experience there that was just by complete fluke that it turned it into a really positive experience. So instead of, like, you know, when someone runs 100Ks, they're like enjoying the pain and you're like, the fuck is wrong with you? Like, sadistic. But I don't think they know how. They just say, you hear them talk about it, they go, yeah, I just love, you know, grinding and the hard work and I just love the suffering. I think something chemically has gone fucking wrong in there from their childhood, and now their perception of it is so different that we could never understand it, right? Perception of reality. So that when they're feeling that pain, it like weirdly gets them going. It's like the people that, you know, like to self-harm and they get off on it, right? They've had some weird childhood experience, which is kind of hacked that neurochemistry. And we've just done this, but in a sporting context or in a physical context.
Yeah, but I mean, I think a lot of people do that. Like, from a personal training perspective, you get people who essentially almost want to bleed in the gym because it's, I don't know, they feel guilty if they don't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Or the fighters that get into the cage and it's like when the blood's pouring and their fucking lips hanging off their face, like that's when they're having fun.
That's what they want.
But then you've got the guys like GSP who are like, oh, I don't even like fighting. I've never done a street fight in my life. It's like best in the world. But
yeah, it's hilarious.
I think that's a good place to finish. Luke, where can people find out more info about you?
Yeah, luketulloch.com or @_LukeTulloch. It's all there.
Yeah, we'll link it up in the description of this episode. But awesome. Luke, thanks for being on. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Awesome. Guys, thank you so much for tuning into this episode today with Luke. We hope you enjoyed it. Take a screenshot of this episode. Tag Luke. Tag us. It's your way of communicating to us saying, hey, thumbs up. That was a sick episode, guys. Thank you so much. Do more of these. So we really appreciate it when you guys do that. And then, of course, it just lets your friends, lets your network know the kind of stuff you listen to, the kind of stuff you dig, and they can jump on if they like it as well. We talked about two companies today working against gravity. They are Nutrition Coaching. If you guys want to work with them as well, even if it's for a short period of time, just to boost some of your knowledge to kind of get the expert help, you can use the code MMP50 when you sign up for their Nutrition Coaching. You'll get $50 off that first month. That is just for our My Muscle Project listeners. And then, of course, as well, we are working with True Protein. If you guys go to trueprotein.com.au, use the code MindMuscle10, you will get 10% off any and all of their products. Guys, thank you so much, and we'll speak to you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the Mind Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the Mind Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.